Hello, everyone. My name is Shane Sanders. As you may have caught on, I'm a Master of Fine Arts candidate at UW-Stout. After receiving my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree in Drawing and Painting at UW-Eau Claire, I decided to take my area of study to design. It appeals to my jack-of-all-trades nature, since design is connected to everything. Everywhere we look, there is evidence of design, even if we don't stop to notice or think about something as design. But just like a great work of fine art, good design has a tendency to smack you in the face so you take notice. Well, that's exactly what happened when I first laid eyes on my object that was found within the walls of Harvey Hall during its recent renovation. Much like Drew's film, it was a mystery to try and piece together why it was there and how it related to art and design at Stout at all. So, here we are in the final segment of the podcast, where I, your groovy host, will take you through the far-out 1960s to the tubular 1980s, as our quest to understand the birth of the Department of Art and Design at Stout reaches its zenith and explodes into the dawning of the Age of Aquarius. And what is this object that ties all of this research data together with terribly dated references and vernacular? A soda can. A single, beautifully designed orange masterpiece that not only perfectly illustrates what we as artists and designers do for the world, but whose timeline parallels events that would transform the very fabric of a small state university in western Wisconsin. Events that did not happen on their own, true believers, oh no. So travel back with me in this segment as I reveal how a soda can relates to the changing landscape of art and design taught and practiced at Stout, how the vibrant community of art students and faculty strengthen the endeavor of an evolving program, and how clairvoyant vision, combined with determination and fortitude, allowed the School of Design to blossom into the well-known entity it is today. First, let's go over a little history of this amazing can I found. Although the name Sunrise referred to a soda brand as early as 1931, this particular soda comes to us from Sunrise Incorporated, located in Marshall, Minnesota. In 1956, Sunrise Incorporated purchased the rights to the name from Sunrise Bottling Company in Tazewell, Virginia, and franchised their orange beverage to Coca-Cola. It was bottled in a number of states, including Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Kentucky, Indiana, Arkansas, and Mississippi. It's a beautiful fluorescent orange can with a large white bottle cap-shaped sunburst, containing the words, "Orange Soda," in the same eye-catching orange as the can. The words Sunrise crown the can in white. We are also proudly reminded in an instantly recognizable mid-20th century font in the Gill, Sands, or Futura family that this product is artificially colored and preserved with benzoate of soda.
What is that?
I don't know. A preservative.
Sounds really good for you.
Yeah. The can is made of sturdy steel construction rather than aluminum, and has a pull-tab top. Yeah.
Old school.
Yeah, I don't know if you ever used a pull-tab top. For those of you not familiar with the pull-tab, it was a design that dominated the market in the 1960s and early 1970s. Before the pull-tab, if you wanted a soda, you had to use a can opener to open a can.
Keep one of those in your back pocket.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you had to punch two holes in the top of the can, one to drink out of and one to let the air flow. I used to have to open my chocolate syrup for my ice cream like that when I was a kid. So one day in 1959, an engineer named Ermal Fraze went on a picnic, and he forgot to put his can opener in his back pocket, like you said.
Simple mistake.
Yeah, shouldn't have done it. After using a car bumper to open his beer, he stayed up all night until he had come up with a solution. An aluminum ring connected by a rivet to this pre-scored wedge-shaped portion of the top of the can. And so you just put your finger through the tab and pulled the ring. And when it was pulled, it removed the elongated wedge, and that allowed the beverage to pour out and the air to flow all simultaneously.
Genius.
Yeah. It was better than having to use a can opener, but after years of people turning the pull tab into sharp pieces of litter, the stay-on tab that's widely recognized today was invented. And that's no joke, because I remember as a kid going to the beach and having pull can tops laying all over the beach. So all of these clues, steel construction, mid-20th century font, and pull tab top, along with knowing that this design is the third generation of can style, thanks to our friends at canconnection.com, leads me to believe that this can of soda was enjoyed somewhere in Harvey Hall in the mid to late 1960s, which is a perfect parallel and a great segue into the beginning of the School of Art and Design at Stout. Sometime during the 1963-64 school year, a meeting took place between then-president of Stout, William J. Michaels, and Orazio Fumagalli from the art department at the University of Minnesota Duluth about heading the chair of a newfound art department at Stout. President Michaels promised Fumagalli a $2 million building and his full support. An agreement was reached, and the art department at Stout was born. Fumagalli seemed a good choice for the job. Going through his writings, you can tell that he was a dreamer, a tad eccentric, and a bit of a romantic, yet hardworking and eager to achieve the vision of a strong art and design program at Stout. When he described the early days of the department in his writings, you could tell that he recalled them fondly and was thankful for what he had a chance to build. He surrounded himself with good young talent and ensured that their needs as artists were met. Fumagalli was adamant that the instructors at Stout should be working, practicing artists. And thanks to their teaching contracts, every faculty member was to be provided with studio space to focus on their art while teaching.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was. The state of the studios might not have been so awesome, but we'll get to that.
Tell me more.
The first facilities for the art department were humble and sporadic. The department started as a locker room in the basement of Harvey Hall and expanded to empty homes and abandoned apartments for studio space. So they basically just kind of went out and grabbed whatever they could find for these faculty's art studios. The many empty houses that served as art studios were in constant danger of being torn down. And one story goes that faculty member Dion Manriquez came to his studio one morning to find that it was being demolished.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, he had to plead with the crew to stop long enough for him to get his paintings out. A one-story flat-roofed leaky garage that had once been a beer depot served as the printmaking and art metal studios, and fundamentals of design students learned in a building that once served as a Baptist church. It's at this point where a little imagination is needed on your part, dear listener. In the early 1960s America, soda is a popular beverage among young people. It's not hard to picture one or more of our mischievous or lazy students buying this orange beauty in a corner store and, while guzzling it down on the way to class, enter Harvey Hall. After taking the last drink, they find the trouble of locating a trash receptacle too much effort. Happening upon a random space in the wall in which the can will fit, it is inserted, where it falls between the cracks to rest for 50 years. Could have been a hole made for an updated furnace or antiquated plumbing system, or perhaps an unfinished wall that was quickly being constructed to try and accommodate the numerous growing programs like the art department in the basement.
Maybe.
There are any myriad of situations possible in which a soda can ended up in the wall of that building. But, like Bob Ross said, however you think it should be, that's how it should be. It's your story, dear listener, you paint it however you like, but I digress. Back to the fledgling art department's journey into the unknown. In 1965-66, the art department took over the old farmer's store located on the corner of 5th and Broadway. It was going to be used by the fire department, who had already started to remodel the space, but the citizens of Menominee voted against the building being used for that purpose. The faculty got to work transforming the partly remodeled building into their new headquarters. The first floor held an exhibition gallery, a storeroom slash workroom for the gallery, the art office, and five narrow faculty studios. Some real studios.
Real studios, not in the old apartment?
Yeah. The basement contained ceramics, a slide library, a drawing studio, and a sculpture studio. During the fire department's remodeling, the back quarter of the first floor was torn out so that the basement could be filled with earth to take the weight of their large trucks. It was because this never happened that the space was perfect for sculpture. It now had a ceiling that was two stories high. And this would later influence the design of the sculpture studio in the new Applied Arts building.
Huh.
Yeah.
Happy accident.
Yeah, right. The empty back lot of the building was used for the ceramics kiln and the sculpture furnace. The large mess of materials in the lot led President Michaels to, quote-unquote, suggest building a fence to hide the eyesore. I think they appreciated it very much. But the maintenance crew budget could not sustain offense, so the staff were forced to ask students for help instead. The students wanted the fence to represent the art program, so they built something unique of their own design, and this led to the construction of the infamous Funk Fence.
Funk Fence.
let us not forget that we are discussing the 1960s.
Makes sense.
Yeah. The free love movement and drug counterculture of the day produced a mindset of openness and experimentation. The so-called funk fence that the students had constructed was inspired by a movement at the time coined funk art, whose aesthetic mirrored the free spirit of youth in the 60s and focused less on craft. Fumagalli described the fence as a spontaneous and uninhibited, honest and accurate expression of the age. Guy's great. To the untrained eye, surely the fence was a shoddy, hodgepodge collection of wooden scraps. To his credit, President Michaels shielded the art department from the outcry of the community about their repugnant fence. Although the fence was vandalized a time or two, the students simply rebuilt it, turning the damaged areas into focal points of the new composition. The fence survived for years, until the art department eventually moved into their new building. A poem was written by Bill Shulman to honor the fence. Even though both Shulman and Fumagalli had forgotten that the fence was vandalized, it made a fitting tribute.
North of the muted bottling plant, north of my Olga Breck studio, north of the bat-filled Baptist church, we filled all the niches in the old farmer's store, where Don's Super Value parking lot now stands. North of our dusty spaces, north of our acquired art center, between the chancellor's house and the fraternity house, between fantasy and practicality, between the pot shop and the sculpture shed, we built our fence of discarded aesthetic. Our fence became as mighty as Fort Snelling, as visible as Elk Mound, as representative of who we are as Alzerin Crimson and Grog. We watched as the community paid homage, shaking tongues and twitching eyebrows at our Cristo run wild. They came singly and in pairs, murmuring sotto voce about how they thought they hated it. But talk is talk and love is love. Our fence, suffering this torment, as ridiculed as Jackson Pollock, more outrageous than senseless graffiti, stood reflective, gaudy, joyful, and held its ground with grace and without a single case of vandalism. Eventually, we moved east and a bit south and lost our fence of vulnerability.
As the students left their endearing mark on the program, so too did the dedicated faculty and staff. Not only were they making an impact on the students, but their work was garnering attention from the media. In the Sunday, January 30th, 1972 issue of the Minneapolis Tribune, journalist Mike Steele wrote a piece titled Artists of the Menominee Phenomenon, in which he highlighted the young, talented staff of artists/teachers at Stout. Why are you laughing? Menominee Phenomenon is very hard to say. I bet you cannot say that five times fast.
You don't think I can?
No.
Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon, Menominee Phenomenon. Ha!
Now I feel like an idiot. Moving on. The article explained the atmosphere of the art department and showcased the philosophies and work of the teachers who were given studio space and expected to lead by example. Charles Wimmer, 1966 to 2000, painting and drawing. Todd Boppel, 1963 to 73, painting. Doug Cumming, 1967 to 2001, painting and drawing. Gerald Hanna, 1971 to 76, painting. And Rob Price, 1970 to 2009, printmaking painting, were some of those featured. While the program flourished, Orazio Fumagalli continued striving to make the program the best it could be. Around 1966-67, the seed was being planted for the School of Design. The art department received a grant, which allowed them to study how artists were being used in an industrial setting. During my research, it wasn't clear to me from whom they had received the grant, but one can assume that it was probably the state or federal government.
Most likely.
Yeah. With this grant money, Fumagalli and Mike Jerry from the art department, along with Jim Bjornrud from the School of Industrial Technology, visited companies like General Motors to learn all that they could about the process inside the large companies. They also visited independent design firms and other schools of design to discover what was being taught and what traits employers found most desirable. They learned that designers who could communicate by sketching while they talked due to strong foundations in painting and sculpture were favorite candidates of employers. Fumagalli knew then that they were on the right track. For at least 5 years after this research, the art department petitioned to add industrial and interior design to the art program.
Makes sense.
During those years of petition, President Michaels had finally made good on his promise for a permanent home for the art department. Instead of the $2 million building it guaranteed Fumagalli back in 1963, he delivered on a $4.7 million 91,000 square foot facility.
Wow.
That would more than meet the needs of the program. It was the last hurrah of President Michaels, as he soon retired, but Fumagalli would always remain grateful to the man he considered responsible for the creation of his growing program. And he really did.
Yeah, it seems like it.
Yeah, he loved Michaels. He referred to him in his writings as the Philosopher King.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's pretty cool. Soon came a changing of the guard, and with the completion of the new Applied Arts Building, Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs Wes Vase authorized concentrations in industrial and interior design. Victory, finally. Mm-hmm. With the dream of the School of Art and Design now a reality, the new Applied Arts Building opened with large fanfare on November 17, 1973. A unique festival was held in celebration that included a marching band and ribbon-cutting ceremony. The building then held activities for the public so that people could understand the concentration of each area, including art, packaging, manufacturing, production processing, and the Center for Research and Educational Improvement. Eventually, in 1984, the building was named for the man whose vision had made it a reality, William J. Michaels. The building served the campus well, but in 1988, requests were put in for the remodeling of the building regarding purpose-built and designated design studios for growing enrollment in industrial, interior, and graphic design. While the Applied Arts Building continued to grow and change with the times, Sunrise Cola was seeing its decline in the market due to the franchising of other more popular orange sodas like Orange Crush. Only a few bottlers continued to make Sunrise past the 1980s. Although the last Sunrise soda came off of the assembly line in the Coca-Cola bottling plant of Winona, Minnesota in 2012, we are still reminded by its predecessor, who lay preserved in a wall for 50 years, that something as simple as a can of soda can help us recall events of significance if we are willing to draw lines and ask the right questions. From the Design Seminar Masterclass, this has been Discarded Design, a reflection on art in ephemera, with
Nicolette Morgan,
Darshana Gopalakrishnan,
Drew Hagen,
and Shane Sanders.